is a June rate hike back on the table?
The Fed, it's hinting that maybe they're going to do something stupid, in my mind, to prove a point.
Now we're going back into an environment where the Fed's going to have to make decisions and they're going to have to move.
This would be the time to do it before you get into the election.
Raising the rate a quarter of a point is hardly going to affect how many mortgages are let, how much investment goes on, or anything like that.
The fundamental data, the earnings, the economic data, and the Fed tightening, those are three major tailwinds that drove the bull market for the last 6-7 years. They're all reversing now.
Do you fear the Fed?
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, will they or won't they? What am I talking about? Raise or lower the interest rates? Haven't we heard this before? And we're back at it again this year. Greetings, everybody. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour for this week. I'm John Loeffler. Jim Poplava is out this week, but never fear. We have an action-packed show lined up for you, if we can actually describe action-packed in terms of financial reporting. Speaking of reporting, in the first hour, Ryan Poplava will be with us for his normal weekly update regarding the markets. Gary Dorsch here, the Fed confident the U.S. economy is on steady ground, and, well, like I said, are they going to raise the rates or not? They seem to be prepared to raise interest rates, but, well, that's going to remain that typical ongoing speculation that we've seen over the last year and a half. Ned Schmidt will be with us for a report on commodities, looking especially today at gold and oil. And in the second hour, Chris Sheridan will host Dr. Peter Vincent Pry on the existential threat of EMPs. It'll be a special edition of The Big Picture, reprising two recent programs from an FS Insider segment. All of that today, coming up on the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, as I mentioned before, Ryan Poplava will give us an update on the markets. And Ryan, I'm going to start with a terrifically insightful question. What's going on in the world of finance and economics? Anything new and exciting? How does that?
That is, you stumped me. What is exciting? No, I think the real story this week was the Federal Open Market Committee's minutes from the April meeting that was released on Wednesday, kind of threw investors for a loop a little bit. The statement that if data was consistent with growth picking up in the second quarter, labor conditions strengthened, and inflation neared its 2% target, then most of the participants judged it would be appropriate to raise in June. And, you know, we started getting some FOMC voting members coming out with speeches on Tuesday, essentially saying that they felt it was appropriate, that June was on the radar. So when that was confirmed by the minutes, that kind of really boosted the federal funds rate futures for that rate hike, the probability of it at least. And just to give you some perspective here, on Monday, before the Tuesday FOMC members, before the minutes on Wednesday, the probability of a June hike was around 4%, John. And after everything was said and done, it got to as high as 34% after the minutes on Wednesday before settling down a little bit around 26% on Friday. That's not a lot. Like I said, it went from 4% and then just spiked. So that spike, sitting at 4%, you know, there's a little bit of complacency there, right? So that definitely weakened things up a bit midweek. So the probabilities, like I said, still low, but the July probabilities, John, much higher. It was at one point this week above 50%. So it was a big jump this week, jolted investors' expectations. Dollar rose as a result this week. So materials had a hard time of things, except for crude, which was being lifted on some other things. You know, that was offset by, I would say, the jump in financials and to a later extent in the week, tech stocks, which did well based off of some earnings results. But stocks, for the most part, held up rather well, I think, given the complacency shock by those Fed officials in the minutes, and especially, I think, bounced back on Friday in a good way. I think technically, you know, we saw some support levels that they didn't hold so much on Thursday, but we came back on Friday right back above them. So that probably encouraged some buying. It was also, I think, options expiration. So a little bit of noise probably there, a little bit from a technical standpoint. But Friday, tech stocks led on great earnings from Applied Materials had an upbeat guidance for the rest of its fiscal third quarter. So that really played into the biotechnology area, basically the NASDAQ. NASDAQ did very well on Friday. But Applied Materials, you know, what they do is they manufacture the equipment needed to make microchips. So if they're doing well, the guys who supply the guys who make the chips, then investors inferred that tech is doing well. And that's what moved on Friday.
Okay, well, talk to me about economic announcements this week. We're seeing releases. Do you suppose they're actually supporting the rate hike concept for June?
The most recent major economic releases, we talked about the retail sales last Friday. That was a very big number and a surprise to the upside. Housing starts, we got that this week. It was positive, a positive change. Industrial production, again, another surprise to the upside. And the consumer price index was showing that all of those are checking out and supporting the areas the Fed mentioned it wants to see conditions essentially consistent with growth. So the unfortunate issue for investors is that due to the groupthink surrounding the Fed's accommodation plans, unfortunately, good economic news is not good news for the market. Essentially, that's where it seems that we're falling currently. And if you look at economic results since the beginning of this month, the dollar's been up. It's been following those great economic results. And, you know, the expectation is that the Fed, well, at this point, will likely go between June and July. That to me, John, is frustrating because, you know, it shows how much investors have been programmed by the Fed's era of helicopter money and that we can't just take, you know, these economic results for what they are and anticipate that maybe the second quarter GDP results will be better based off of that. And then that's a good thing, you know, and see prices go up. But this is also off the heels of a great move from February to end of April. So, you know, the macro consensus continues to be, like I said, I would just say weighed down by the Fed's plans to remove accommodation. That and obviously earnings growth have been a little bit frustrating, but there's been a lot of surprises this season and a lot of guidances I've seen have been lifted. And, you know, valuations, yes, they're also capping the market from, I would say, maybe new highs. But, you know, if earnings can't turn around in the second quarter, yeah, you know, I'm curious how the bulls will really still be able to defend stock values. But like I said, we've had some good results this quarter on surprises and some guidances. So we'll just have to see how the second quarter earnings season plays out in a couple of months here. But, you know, so far the economics are improving. Oil has improved and the dollar fell in April to kind of help multinationals. But yeah, the dollar's coming back in May. And that seems to be a little bit of a headwind.
Yeah, it does. Question here. If we look at the news this week, has it really affected your investment plans any? Should investors be concerned?
Well, like I mentioned 3 weeks ago, I started removing some exposure to the market. For the most part, we're still leaning on, from long-term perspective, the conditions of a late-stage economic cycle, which you still see growth in that cycle. You still see areas that, from a sector standpoint, do well and perform well in that time period, typically based off last 30 years of historical returns. So we have raised our level of bond exposure since last year. Recent results haven't really changed our long-term outlook for that late-stage economic cycle. Like I said, we've lifted up our bond exposure, lowered our stock exposure a little bit. The short-term outlook, though, I would say for me personally, has changed a little bit based on how much the market has been able to essentially weather the idea of a June hike. It's been able to weather, you know, the rather large move we had from February to April. We're not really correcting very steeply. I haven't seen a lot of risk indicators really jump up like we did in January and August of last year. I thought we might head down towards possibly, you know, 2011, currently where the 200-day average is for the S&P 500. And that's still a possibility. You know, we still just barely traded and closed above, you know, 2040 was the key level I was watching this week. And we're still somewhat, you know, right around that 50-day moving average, which is currently 2060. We're below that. So, you know, I mentioned last week that the market has been resilient and continues to see, I think, some support near 2040. And anything below that seems to be temporary. We dipped really briefly below that on Thursday. However, you know, I'm not sure we have the gusto yet to leave 2100 based on, like I said, valuations. But, you know, it's interesting this week. I don't know if you saw, but the 13F filing came in from George Soros that hit the headlines on, I think it was Tuesday. Mm-hmm. He showed that he doubled his short position in the S&P 500 while boosting his gold position. That's suggesting, John, a really defensive position. And as I mentioned, I think, what was it, 2 weeks ago, Icahn mentioned he had done the same. Essentially, he saw commodities doing okay. I guess he's maintaining his hedges. I think from last week, we looked at that. You know, that all makes sense. You know, a few weeks ago when stocks were trading near their highs, had just come off of a very major one-way rally. You know, but I'm not so sure there's enough bearish pressure to really take us down to those February and October lows. Like I said, you know, I was looking at some stress indicators like the volatility index that's been flat throughout all this consolidation, and some of our other financial stress indicators that we watch, you know, really aren't pricing in the kind of risk we were seeing in January when economic news was starting to weaken in the US. And of course, all the changes that China made in its currency. But we still have Japan as an unknown. There's the G7 meeting. What are they going to do? Are there any policy changes? The Bank of Japan is a very major unknown at this point, what their plans are for the yen. And that could result in changes for China. Obviously, also, there's the Brexit, the British exit debate from the EU and the euro. So that's coming up in June. So if the market's going to start getting concerned about that kind of stuff, well, we should see that in the next few weeks.
Well, you mentioned the Brexit. That's going to be a really interesting one, because if you look at the quantity of digital ink being spilled on it right now, especially from some of the globalist institutions, shall we say, they're all having fits about this whole potential separation of Great Britain from the European Union. So that's one of the issues. Anything else over the next week or so that you have on your macro radar that may influence investors and their position in the market?
Over the next couple of weeks, the kind of economic results we'll get, obviously, we want to see if it continues to support the FOMC minutes, the conditions they want to see for that June hike. So I guess on that note, we get the Flash Purchasing Managers Index data on Monday. That's mainly for the US and Europe and Japan. We don't really see China's anymore. They don't publish it till the end of the month. Durable goods orders on Thursday. And I think there was some housing data as well, which has been strong lately. So not really a big week in economics next week. That's going to be saved for the following week, the first week of June. We'll get the employment data and a slew of, you know, manufacturing services information as well. So that's the big week in 2 weeks, really, to look at data that supports the June hike. Like I said, this weekend, I think it's already started. The G7 are meeting in Japan, but there haven't been any kind of major headlines that I've seen here on Friday. But if there are over the weekend, obviously to see how the markets react on Monday. But especially we want to see if there's any kind of new details on Japan's policies regarding its yen. You know, they didn't do anything at the end of April, and that really threw off currencies a little bit. The yen strengthened a lot, but since has been weakening off of some discussion from Japan, some headlines. So really, we want to see what goes on there and if the yen weakens a lot, if China reacts to that. After next week, like I said, things should get more exciting. There's also the OPEC meeting on June 2nd, John. I don't think they'll cut production, but there's been obviously all that talk about freezing. So far as just that, just talk. But here we are sitting in the high 40s for crude oil. So it's done a good thing. On top of that, obviously, the U.S. is cutting production. That's helped. But no, I think the Brexit referendum, that will probably weigh in on any kind of probabilities on the Fed hiking in June. That's why, John, you know, the probabilities are so much higher for a July hike. So it'll be interesting. But, you know, like I said, so far, stocks have been resilient. I haven't seen any kind of earth-shattering evidence of any kind of crisis condition. Obviously, the stuff we're seeing in Venezuela, that's not very constructive from a global standpoint. But so far, it doesn't seem to be really affecting markets worldwide.
Not too sure where that's going to go, actually, at this time in the future. So, but that time will unravel that, I'm sure. And Ron Poplava, appreciate it. Next week, you're going to be gone. Chris Sheridan will be doing the market report next week, as Chris will be joining us later in the program to do some interviews, later being almost next. So, thanks. I'm not sure what the difference is between next and almost next. Anyway, thanks, Ryan.
Well, like I said, next week's going to be boring, so good. I'll just take a break and get back when it gets more exciting.
Wait till I tell Chris that. Okay.
Yeah, don't tell him. I'll let him figure it out.
Take care, Ryan.
We'll see you, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
One of the most important political issues facing Europe this year will occur on Thursday, June 23rd, when British citizens head to the polls to decide whether, after 45 long years, if the UK should exit the EU. We are joined today by two leading analysts at Global Risk Insights, Michaela Sorensen and Nandini Rao, to debate the case for and against a so-called Brexit, and to understand why, as many are stating, that this is one of the most important macroeconomic issues facing the world today. Michaela, let's start with you. You believe that the UK should leave the EU. Why is that?
Well, Chris, I think so because I think an exit from the EU would save Britain a lot of the downside, while diplomacy could save most of the upside for Britain. I think one of the topics that is especially acute in this debate, and which I think points to Brexit as the favorable outcome, is the excessive regulation that the EU is imposing on business in the UK. And this is a burden which is especially felt by small and medium-sized businesses, which constitute most of the UK's economy, in fact. It might not tear the union apart necessarily, but it will change the structure of it either to greater union or to a more decentralized union. And I think it's only natural for the UK to step out at this point because it's not interested in a closer union. And this, in a sense, would only be the first step to a more decentralized union in the case where that's the outcome.
Nandini, explain why you believe Britain should remain in the EU and not vote to leave on June 23rd.
Well, there's a very old proverb which says that united we stand and divided we fall. And I think if the UK does leave, then it's not a fall. The near-term consequences domestically, at least, would be very severe in economic terms. And this could have negative spillover effects on the UK's growth long-term. And also, by leaving the EU, the UK may not only suffer from negative economic effects, but it may also lead to questions about the EU's future, as the approach to exit might result in other countries clamoring for their own referendum. And also, negotiating the terms of the agreement would be quite time-consuming. So in the interim period, there would be a lot of uncertainty, which could pull down growth while pushing up inflation, as the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney highlighted in his report yesterday.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up next, we have the Technician's Report with Gary Dorsch, and also gold and oil and commodities with Ned Schmidt. And to handle all of that is Chris Sheridan. Chris?
The U.S. economy is driven largely by the American consumer, accounting for roughly 70% of all economic growth. For that reason, many analysts keep a careful eye on the retail space for any hints of a slowdown. And with a large number of retailers now losing money, seeing double-digit plunges in the price of their stock and closing up stores around the U.S., the big question many are now asking is whether the carnage we see in the retail sector today, if that is sending a recessionary signal for the U.S. economy. Joining us on the show today is Gary Dorsch. He is the editor of Global Money Trends magazine. And Gary, tell us, what are your thoughts on the carnage that we are seeing in the retail sector? Do you think that this is sending indeed a recessionary signal here for the U.S.?
Thank you very much for having me on the show today, Chris. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, we are seeing some major shifts in consumer spending habits, where more U.S. consumers now are buying their purchases online as opposed to traveling to a brick-and-mortar department store. And as a result, we are seeing some big changes in equity values in the marketplaces. So those companies that are well-known as brick-and-mortar department stores, such as Macy's and Nordstrom's, Sears and Roebuck, Kohl's, as an example, have seen their stock prices drop in half by about 50% compared where they were at their peak levels a year ago. And the company that is dominating the online retail sector, Amazon, ticker symbol AMZN, has seen its stock price more than double from its lows of a year ago, from $300 a share to just over $700 a share recently. And the government says that retail sales for online is up about 10% compared with a year ago, while sales at brick and mortar down about 2.5% on average compared with a year ago. So overall, the government says not to worry. Core retail sales, subtracting out the effects of gasoline and auto sales, just looking at other sales besides those two areas, were up almost 5% in the month of April compared with a year ago. So for those who think that the downturn in the retail sector index funds such as XRT, which contains 100 of the top retailers, all equally weighted, has dropped right now to a bear market territory, down 20% from last year's high. The question is whether this is signaling the onset of a recession. The answer, at least for now, is no, it's not. It's just reflecting the change in consumer spending habits. I would say if we saw a sharp downturn in Amazon, however, then I would be more concerned about that. So it is part of the equation, something to keep an eye on. But for now, at least from a macroeconomic point of view, I would say it's more focused on the problems that these department stores are having as the world evolves more into the internet-related world where we're all increasingly involved with.
Okay, so the steep decline that we're seeing in a lot of these brick-and-mortar stores, in your mind, is not necessarily sending a recessionary signal. This is more of an indication of the large changes we see afoot in consumer spending patterns using Amazon and e-commerce. If you look on a chart on a St. Louis Fred website, you can see that e-commerce as a percent of total retail sales has climbed steadily from around the 2000s. In the year 2000, it was under 1%, and it's just steadily increased. And now we are around 8%, 7.8% for the first quarter of 2016. So that's still a very small portion, only 7.8% of total sales, retail sales. So there's a lot of room to grow there. And so perhaps we're just seeing the beginning signs of brick and mortar getting hit by this growing trend.
Well, brick and mortar will have to also beef up their online sales. They'll have to become more competitive with Amazon. And Walmart apparently this weekend announced that they're going to try to take Amazon on one-on-one going forward. But other than that, if those that who cannot adjust to the new realities will be facing a dire situation. I think there is a ETF, exchange-traded fund, that mostly focuses or contains the online retailers, that ticker symbol FDN, Frank David Nancy. Might be something for those to look at who are interested in focusing more on the online retailers, Amazon making up about 12% of the portfolio there, trades at a relatively high P of 38 to 1, but anyhow, that's something for investors to consider.
Gary, there are a number of momentous changes afoot, and you highlighted them in a recent piece. We're seeing Amazon take over retail, including apparel. Google, which started out as a search engine company, really just based on a clever math algorithm, is now on track to overtake Apple as the world's most valuable company. And YouTube, which is also owned by Google, now reaches more 18 to 34 year olds in any television network on the planet. So there's some big changes taking place, as you pointed out to earlier, that there are major large scale changes we're seeing in consumer spending habits and how different companies are reaching the American consumer through ad revenues. So there are some changes. And like you said, perhaps the big decline that we're seeing in brick and mortar stores and in the retail ETF XRT doesn't necessarily have to be an imminent recessionary signal. So I do think that's a good point. What are some of the other signals that you're watching or major developments that you're keeping on your radar for where the U.S. economy may be headed?
As we're speaking here this Thursday afternoon, the Federal Reserve officials are speaking to the media, and they seem to be relatively confident that the U.S. economy is on steady ground. It's growing at roughly 2 to 2.5%, and they feel confident enough now to be sending signals to the marketplace that lo and behold, they're prepared to start raising the federal funds rate. And yesterday was a shocking day. The Federal Reserve released its minutes in which it sent signals to the market that, assuming the U.S. economy continues to generate 150,000 jobs or more, that they would be prepared to hike the Fed funds rate as early as the upcoming June 14th meeting, that being just about a month from now. As of last Friday, the Fed fund futures markets were only giving a 4% chance that the Fed would raise the Fed funds rate in June. Now it's a 50-50 proposition as far as the pricing in the Fed funds futures market. So for those who make the big decisions and move the markets, that being the Federal Reserve, apparently the majority of the Federal Reserve members now are confident enough to back a rate hike. And long-awaited, long-overdue, I watch three key indicators on the U.S. economy amongst all the many ones. One is housing prices and housing sales being the biggest ticket item that most families will purchase decision they'll make. Also, auto sales, another very large expenditure. They have the confidence to buy autos and housing. That sends to me that the economy is doing okay. And housing prices have been rising for 4 years, and certain cities are at bubble levels. So we saw back in the previous crisis and up about 4.5% on average compared with a year ago. So doing well in housing. Auto sales are booming at about a 17.5 million annualized rate. That's near record highs. And then the job numbers that come out every month. The economy was generating more than 200,000 jobs a month for quite some time until just this last month when there was a dip to 160,000. And I understand most of the jobs are not high quality. A lot of them are low-paying jobs in the leisure industry and retail, which don't pay all that much. But that's not how the Fed looks at it. I think the Fed looks at the raw numbers and the job figures. And today, Stanley Fischer, the deputy Fed chairman, said, in his opinion, the U.S. economy is now at near full employment and that he's pretty confident the Fed will see its 2% inflation target in the near term. So that's pretty much a signal that he would be willing to back a rate hike. He thinks the economy is doing well enough. And now that oil prices have rebounded by $20 a barrel, we can start to see some of that filter through into the inflation numbers, which will lead to a little higher inflation and give the Fed the impetus to raise interest rates, hiking the Fed funds rate most likely in June or in July by a quarter point from the midpoint of 3/8 to 5/8%. And so the market has reacted negatively to that. That was not something on anyone's radar. It really caught the market off guard. I haven't seen the Fed catch the market this off guard in a long, long time. Usually, the Fed is always threatening to raise rates, and then when the moment of truth comes along, they get cold feet, they back off, and they don't raise the interest rates. And the Fed has a reputation where its credibility had been badly tattered. In fact, there's an old adage, the fate of a liar is that nobody believes him, even when he's telling the truth. So even though the Fed has been threatening to raise rates, they have gotten cold feet so many times in the past that nobody actually believes them when they're saying it. So we now have had 5 or 6 Fed governors on record saying they're prepared to raise rates. And for the first time now, the market's taking it seriously. I see the S&P 500 index today has dropped below a very key interim support level at the 2040 level, now at 2032. So technically that looks negative and will probably continue to fall over the near term as the market adjusts to this rate hike. Just one last note, I would say it's very interesting to note the last time the Fed did raise the Fed funds rate back on December 16th, the S&P 500 was trading at 2,050 at the time, and it dropped down to as low as 1,825 after the Fed raised the rates. That was about a 10% correction. That was the second 10% correction the S&P had endured in the last 12 months. And it's very interesting to note yesterday's release of the minutes in which the Fed pointedly talked about a rate hike in June, the S&P was trading at roughly the same exact level, 2,050. So at the end of the day, as far as Fed policy is concerned and the economy, the Fed is more market dependent than it is data dependent. So when the S&P trades at 2050, you can expect the Fed to make hawkish statements and try to cap off the rise of the market. And if the S&P drops down towards the lower 1800s, you can expect the Fed to say that they're done raising rates and to be sounding more dovish and lending to support to the market. So they're using monetary policy, I think, to try to guide the S&P into a sideways trading range, with 2100 as being the upper end of that range, and let's say 1825 is the lower end. And that's basically how you have to look at the market going forward.
Gary, there's been a number of very large investors that have made announcements that they're either going short or that they're bearish on the market. Carl Icahn is one, George Soros is another, and there's a few other names that we could look at as well. And Goldman Sachs had even just recently announced this week that they had downgraded their stance on global equities and are recommending raising cash. What do you think they're seeing, or what is it that you think that is causing them to be so nervous?
Well, Carl Icahn said that he felt the stock market was artificially high due to artificially low interest rates, and that would correct once the Fed did raise rates, and he's being proven correct now. Goldman Sachs indicated that the P.E. ratio on a forward basis was about as high as it's been historically, higher than in 86% of historical time. So it's really in the upper percentile of extraordinary overvaluations. And Goldman Sachs was also predicting the Fed would raise the Fed funds rate at least two or three times this year. And nobody believed it. It was not something that anyone thought would actually come to pass. So that's where their insight came from. We're going to see the true face of the market when the Fed starts to normalize monetary policy and raises interest rates to more normal levels. It's remarkable that we've now had near 0% interest rates for 7.5 years, and a lot of people become brainwashed to believe that's the new normal. But it's not normal, it's very abnormal. Interest rates should be considerably higher in order to really get the markets balanced correctly, and I think even the economy balanced correctly. So this pattern of adjustment will take place, and if the Fed does continue to raise interest rates, I think at least two times this year, that, you know, we probably have seen the highs in the stock market for now, 2100 on the S&P being the high. And taking a longer term view, which is always a dangerous thing to do, but I would say between now and the end of the year, if the Fed does raise rates two times, that the S&P will go towards the lower end of this trading range near 18.25, 18.50, and from there become a good buy once again, and then there'll be another rally attempt to go up. There's also other factors going on in the world, such as the Chinese economy, which a lot of people are saying could be the big ticking time bomb in the world economy affecting markets around the world. The massive amount of debt that China now has really threatens its economy, and several of the more bearish prognosticators are predicting that China's economy is going to grow much slower than the government is admitting, if it's not already growing much slower. Hong Kong's economy, as I mentioned in this last week's newsletter, contracted in the first quarter. And Hong Kong, of course, is a major trading hub and port of entry into the Chinese mainland. So if Hong Kong is experiencing a contraction, we can probably surmise that mainland China is not growing at 6.7%, as the government says, but probably closer to 5%. So China being the world's locomotive for the world economy as far as growth is concerned, if that does slow down dramatically and we see continued weakness in the Chinese equity markets to confirm that, that could also be negative for the world equity markets. And the other major factor would be the crude oil market. Crude oil is an extremely important commodity for many reasons, but also for the equity markets. We saw late last year and early this year that the Dow Industrials, the S&P, pretty much moved up and down very closely with the price of crude oil. And crude oil is a major reason for concern. There was over $250 billion, $250 to $300 billion of junk bonds that are in the energy industry. Already 40 somewhat smaller energy companies have gone bankrupt on their debt. And if the price of oil was to drop again for any reason back under $40, that could signal worries back in the junk bond market that some other energy companies may come under stress and possibly default. And that would be a reason for worry. So if China's economy slowed down and the world economy slowed down and if oil went down along with it, if Federal Reserve interest rate hikes increase the value of the U.S. dollar and weaken commodity prices, including oil, then that could get the junk bond market all worried again and possibly ricochet to the equity market. So these are at least some of the danger points to keep in mind. Not everything is negative, however. The biggest buyer in the U.S. stock market is the companies themselves. They've been on a massive buying binge now for many years, buying over $2 trillion of their own stock, that being through stock buybacks. So whenever there are sharp pullbacks, we see the companies, the S&P 500 companies, coming in and buying and turning the market back up again. So nothing will go in a straight line. I believe the buybacks will continue, especially whenever there is a sharp pullback. The major companies will take that as an opportunity to buy, and you'll get some decent interim spike rallies. But it's all in the hands of the Fed. If the Fed does raise rates a couple of times this year, the trend will start to turn down between now and the end of the year.
Gary, given some of the things that we discussed, that is that the huge plunge in the retail sector is perhaps not a strong recessionary signal as it has been in the past, given that this may just be a reflection of consumer spending habits changing rather than a sign of a major slowdown as consumers switch more towards online retail markets like Amazon. And perhaps when we think about monetary policy and even the large investors that we cited, Carl Icahn, George Soros, and others that have turned bearish on the stock market. At this point, what do you think the best advice is for investors? Would you say that being cautious going forward is the correct posture? Would you say raising cash? Or are there any other takeaways for our listeners?
Well, assuming the Fed does raise interest rates a couple of times, that's the assumption I'm going to make. I think they will go at least 0.5% to 87 basis points on the Fed funds rate by the end of the year. It'll be a very difficult environment in which to try to make money in the markets. Bond prices, at best, will be flat, possibly dip a little bit, and equity markets can drop even more, 5 to 10% on the major indices. Even the gold market, which has been a stellar performer this year, has been in a little bit of a state of shock. Gold was just at $1,280 an ounce 24 hours ago, now down 30 off from yesterday's high at $1,250, as the gold traders had not anticipated the Fed would raise rates, and now they're beginning to be concerned. So it's possible two rate hikes by the Fed could possibly knock the gold market down towards $1,200 from $1,250. And many other commodities would find it very difficult because the U.S. dollar will probably rise against most major currencies if the Fed tightens U.S. dollar liquidity, especially as Japan and Europe are printing money and trying to weaken their currencies through quantitative easing and negative interest rates. If you have the Fed raising rates and you have negative interest rates in Europe and Japan, the dollar, at least theoretically, should go up against the euro and the yen, and that would put a ceiling over the commodity markets, if not weaken them. So, yes, if you're a long-term investor, it's time to be defensive. Might want to find some type of insurance against a small decline. But the Fed will not tighten so much as to precipitate a bear market. They are very much preoccupied with market trends, and they watch every tick in the stock market that is paramount to their thinking. So I think the Fed is trying to guide the market into this sideways trading range. And you'll hear the hawkish talk when the S&P is at 2,050 or higher, and you'll start to hear some dovish talk if they should be successful in engineering maybe a 5 or 10% pullback in the market. And this, in their mind, is nothing major or tragic for the economy, as only 10% of U.S. households have any substantial amount of monies invested in the equity markets. 90% have very little invested in the market of their assets. So this won't really have much of an impact on the overall economy, but more on the wealth of the wealthier households. So that would be my overall outlook going forward.
Gary, would you mind telling our listeners how they could find out more about Global Money Trends magazine and more of your work?
Just go to globalmoneytrends.com. I have a blogger you can go to. Throughout the week, I normally post one or two little blogger articles on some areas of interest that are occurring during the week. I also work on a newsletter, and it's published Friday evenings, that covers the major developments in the market. You'll see charts and graphs that you can't get elsewhere, and a lot of these charts you'll get some examples of at the globalmoneytrends.com website. So you can find me there and get a pretty good glimpse of the type of work that I do.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
You may not know it, but American spending habits on booze, gambling, and escorts provide a unique glimpse into the future direction of the U.S. economy. Andrew Zetlin, head of Moneyball Economics and one of America's leading economic forecasters, joins us today to give an update on his Vice Index and the trends he's watching. And Andrew, before you explain to us some of the insights that we can draw from McDonald's all-day breakfast menu and the new fad of cuddling within the escort services arena, would you mind giving our listeners a brief background on your Vice Index, what exactly it measures, and just how successful of a leading indicator it is?
Sure, absolutely. I think that's an important place for us to start, is get a good lay of the land. Luxury spending, everyone knows that luxury spending is the canary in the coal mine when it comes to where the consumer is. It either ebbs or flows depending on how much money we have. When we feel flush, when we feel really good, we're going to go out and we're going to spend not just on the daily needs, but on the wants as well. The challenge has always been for economists, how do we measure those luxury goods? For example, we know that the top 1% goes after art, and so you could track what's going on with Sotheby's. You could look at Tiffany sales. But for everyone else, you know, where do we go and what's going to define luxury spending? And that's where economists kind of get hung up. So what I did is I cracked the code, and I track four specific, I'll call them vices, because they are a form of luxury spending with a very common set of parameters. I track spending on gambling, prostitution, like you said, booze, broads, blackjack, and bong hits, marijuana. The reason I track those is, A, I can, and there's a lot of historical data. But the other reason is when you start going and drilling into the details, one thing stands out. It's an all-cash business. And that's key, because in order for someone to go out and spend the hundreds of dollars that they're going to spend, when you start backing that out into terms of what does that mean pre-taxes, and if someone's going to go out and spend a day or two of wages, the equivalent of their wages of working for a day or two, then what you're seeing is they really feel good about today and they really feel good about tomorrow, and they've got the money in their pocket, all cash. And so it's a very economically sensitive barometer. So luxury spending, everyone will accept that luxury spending is really important to watch. But the problem has always been how you track it. I'm tracking it by looking at our vice spending, and it has been telling me a lot of good information. It leads consumer spending by a few months. Because once you peel back what you're doing with your wants, if you've got to pull back on your wants, pretty soon you're going to be pulling back on your needs. For example, you're going to eat out less often, eat more at home. This kind of spending trend. And so what I do is I take this data and I translate it into a retail forecast, for example, where I consistently beat consensus on what's going on with the consumer spending in the retail market. But in essence, it's basically tracking human behavior at a very simple level. We all have our ideas of what luxury is. I simply am going on to some forms that cut across every socioeconomic demographic out there. Men, women, you know, whatever your gender, whatever your race, whatever your economic power, you're out there indulging in vice. And I'm leveraging that data the way it should be leveraged to tell us what's really going on with the consumer.
Joining us on the show today is Ned Schmidt. He is the publisher of AgriFood Value View and the Value View Gold Report. And Ned, you were just telling me off the air that we are seeing a wave of consolidations in the food industry and the chemical industry. I know that Bayer had just made an announcement or takeover bid for agricultural giant Monsanto. And I'm reading an article here that this offer comes amid a wave of consolidation in the industry with rivals Dow Chemical, DuPont, and Syngenta all entering mergers recently. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit about what's taking place in the agricultural industry and what's driving this wave of consolidation?
Chris, let's talk about what's behind their thinking. Remember, these people that run these agricultural product companies, they know more about agricultural trends than anybody. I mean, these guys sit at the top of agricultural knowledge. And they're looking out beyond the low prices we had last year. And they're saying Chinese imports of soybeans are going to rise 50% in the next 10 years. The world is having trouble feeding China this year and next. Then we've got India. We've never even talked about India. And the problem is the world cannot feed India. If we wanted to feed India in the next 5 years, we couldn't do it. So these guys and ladies are looking at these longer trends. They're saying these assets are cheap because of the low prices we had last year. And so we've seen ChemChina come in and doing an offer for Syngenta, the Swiss seed and crop protection. These companies have two businesses, seeds and crop protection, which is all your pesticides. And so that merger, for anybody who owns Syngenta, is going slowly because they've got to do some approvals. And that process is taking longer. But it still looks like it'll be done. Now, this week, Monsanto, which had initially tried to buy Syngenta, apparently got an offer from Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, the German chemical company, which also has a large agricultural subsidiary. Now, I think you have to put a low probability on that one because Bayer doesn't have the money to do it. It would have to sell stock and borrow to do it. And there's some overlaps. And there's some egos involved. BASF, the other big German chemical company, is now rumored that they may come in as a white knight. BASF probably would like to buy Monsanto, but they will not do unfriendly takeovers, or at least historically they have. So it's increasingly look like that somebody might buy Monsanto, and I don't know how Monsanto avoids it. In other words, they don't have a good defense against those takeover officers. So I think you'd have to put the odds now of something happening with Monsanto at about 40%, which is fairly high. Then we've got coming this year the Dow-DuPont merger, in which those two companies will form, among other things, two large companies, one of which is a seed and crop protection company. The other company in the industry is FMC. All right, so what you've got is investors losing their positions in Syngenta, possibly losing their positions in Monsanto. That means that money that was in those stocks is going to have to flow into FMC and the ag company that comes out of Dow DuPont. So those two stocks, FMC and the Dow DuPont ag stock, should be of a lot of interest to investors. So investors' money is going to move into those latter two stocks. We're also seeing a restructuring at the smaller company level. While we hear the news about the Syngentas and Monsantos and so on, there's a lot of acquisition activity at the smaller company levels, a lot of which don't trade much or they're private or one or the other. Kumoto just bought a company. There's a small grain company in Indiana, Anderson Grain, which has got an offer from a hedge fund. And so we're seeing a lot of that. And we also have a restructuring coming with JBS. JBS is a Brazilian company, which is the largest animal protein company in the world. In the United States, they own Swift and Pilgrim's Pride. Now, what they're going to do is the stock, because it trades in Brazil, it had one good run, but basically people don't want to buy stocks in Brazil. What they're going to do is they're going to spin off all their international meat operations into JBS, whatever it's going to be called, JBS Food or JBS International, one of the others. That company will be based in Ireland, and the primary trading for the stock for the international company will be in the United States. For the first time, we are going to have a major global player in animal proteins trading in the New York exchanges, U.S. exchanges. That's going to draw some money. It's going to draw sponsorship and trading. JBS is probably one of the best situations right now. The stock's primary trading is in Brazil, but it trades in the United States as an ADR, JBSAY. And that's one investors really need to look at. And there's a lot going on.
Ned, let's move to the agricultural commodity space in general. If we look at the popular DBA, Agricultural Fund, ETF, we see that it's fallen sharply over the years, and it's now at lows that we haven't seen. Well, since it's actually been active, it's at the lowest point going back since 2007, which was when it started. What are your thoughts on the agri-food space in general? You had mentioned soybeans and corn. What are some of the trends that you're watching? Do you think that we're going to see a bounce back in some of these commodities? I know that we have seen some signs of inflation picking up. What are your thoughts?
The United States produces 20% of the world's grains and almost 30% of the export market. So what happens to the United States is what's happening basically to the world. And last year, the dollar was in that ridiculous rally that made no sense. And that dollar was so overvalued. But you've heard the companies reporting about how bad their operations have been impacted. We saw the same thing in agriculture. What happened when the dollar got overvalued, people couldn't afford to buy U.S. grain. While we looked at corn as prices is going down, if you lived outside the United States, the price of corn was actually going up. Well, that activity crushed our export business. And while we don't get reports on a calendar year, in 2015, I would guess that our exports of grains were off 20-25%. Since the dollar's come down, that has all changed. And we're seeing now countries recognize that they weren't providing enough grains and food to their nation. So the buying has been aggressive. 4 months ago, which is in January, our export sales, these are sales, not things actually get exported, were off 25% from a year ago. Last week, they were up 10%. And our exports of wheat, corn, and soybeans, those sales are all positive now from a year ago. So when the dollar is more normally priced, the world is coming in to buy our grains. And there is no nation that can satisfy the unmet demands. China has changed its agricultural policies. And basically what they did is they threw in the towel. What they're doing is they're going to go to a market-based solution for agriculture. What they had been doing is buying grains at high prices from farmers to maintain their income, which means they were stacking it all over the place. They are dropping those policies, and China is going to produce less corn and less soybeans and less wheat every year for the next 5 years. And what they said, we'll just buy from the United States. So the whole outlook is changing, and there is a problem that we cannot expand agricultural production except by small innovations in seeds and herbicides. So the grain markets are going to be extremely tight going forward. And what happened last year, and actually the last 2.5 years, was an aberration caused by some exceptional harvests in the United States and exacerbated by an overvalued dollar. And so the whole outlook is going back to the long-term outlook, which is positive. And as I also said a minute ago, India is now growing faster than China. Their food consumption is about half that of China. And China, India is going to become a major importer of grains. And so if India continues to grow, despite the politicians' best efforts, we're going to see demand out of India in 5 years that the world may not be able to satisfy. So the shortage situation never really went away. It just was masked by some unusual factors.
Okay, so what you're talking about is that there's still demand. the demand component when we're talking about the agricultural space is still there and strong, and that's coming from China and India, which we really can't supply. And you believe that the outlook is for that market to be quite tight. But as you noted in the beginning, we did see quite a strong rally in the US dollar over the past couple of years, starting around 2014 of July. And that also corresponded with a downward move in the price of oil as well. And we have seen the dollar weaken off of its highs. If we look at the trade weighted US dollar index, we can see that it has corrected from its highs, which were met in about January of this year. The dollar does appear to be heading up currently for the month of May. It has been rallying. So I guess the question to you then is, do you think we could see the grain complex, agriculture, commodity complex weaken further if the dollar continues to rally from these levels? How is that tied to your outlook?
Well, I think you've got to back up and look at this assumption that the dollar is going to appreciate. In other words, if you look at the fundamentals, trade, competitiveness, and the stupid way we sign trade agreements, the fundamentals for the dollar are not good. I mean, everywhere is growing faster than the United States. In the first quarter, the U.S. grew 0.5%. Europe grew 0.6%. So at least in the first quarter, Europe is growing faster than the United States. And the only place you can find growth worse than the United States is in countries like Venezuela and Brazil. I mean, it's just not there. And this thought that the dollar is going to rise because the Federal Reserve is going to drive interest rates up, you've got to be smoking something from Colorado to buy that story. I mean, the Federal Reserve has not become an interest rate hawk. They may raise rates in June, but they're not going to do anything else till December. And so we're not going to see Fed raise rates. And what Wall Street has forgotten, it's like some of these people didn't pay attention in economics class. It is the real rate of interest that matters. And U.S. inflation is going up. The median U.S. CPI, which is put out by the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, hit 2.5% year to year last month. That's the highest rate of median CPI inflation since April of 2009, 7 years ago. And so real rates in the United States are not competitive with anybody. And we're not going to see the Federal Reserve driving rates up till a dollar explodes. And they're just not going to do that. And so I think worrying about the dollar being the currency of tomorrow is a fantasy. The currency of tomorrow is the Chinese yuan. Other than what's happening this week, beyond this week or next, it really doesn't bother me, Chris.
Okay. So it sounds like your outlook on the agri-commodity space is quite bullish. I think the three things we could boil it down to that you perhaps cited is the economics, supply-demand situation. You still see demand, growing demand, in places like China and India, and the supply not keeping up pace with that. You think the dollar rally is likely finished, and that we're seeing an uptick in inflation. So those three things taken together would lend towards a bullish outlook on the agri-commodity space, if I got that correct.
That's correct.
Let's talk about oil for a brief moment, because this is certainly something that a lot of people have their eyes on. I take it if you do think that the dollar rally is finished, there's strong inverse correlation between the dollar and oil. Do you think that we have seen the lows for oil? It does appear that it's trying to bump up against resistance here and maybe turning over. But what are your thoughts on the short to medium outlook on the oil space?
Yeah, last time I visited with y'all, we talked about the surplus of production over demand. And we talked about how in the first half of this year, we had like a million and some barrels of surplus. Second half of the year, we're going to have like a couple hundred thousand barrels a day of surplus. And this was the IEA forecast for 6 months. I mean, this was not new information. The IEA has been forecasting this, and the U.S. Energy Agency has also been saying that. So we've gone from over a million barrels a day surplus to essentially a working surplus. So there isn't any reason for the price of oil to move on any big fundamentals. It's going to trade on the news. So I think your observation there that when West Texas Intermediates in the high 40s, it's going to start looking toppy. And when it tries to get back to the low 40s, there'll be some buying interest. And I think that's kind of amazing, Chris, because you went back probably 9 months ago before the panic sell-off to 26. That was essentially the view of the industry. Take the United States, for example. Our production is off, down from last year, and our imports are up 7%. We're back to importing more and more oil. So it probably isn't any reason for oil to move out of this $40 range, barring some unusual event. And I don't see any unusual events out there that could change the price of oil. I still think that means that if you want to invest in oils, you still stay with the major companies. Unless you've got a small company that's got some truly unique situation, I would stay away from smaller companies.
One last question, Ned, is pertaining to oil. We do see that it is overbought when we look at some of the technical indicators, full stochastics and moving averages. So it could pull back. Like you said, we're at the top of that range. And so your thinking is that we'll probably stay in that $40 range for some time. Another area where we certainly saw some resistance come into play and it's now pulling back is gold. It's certainly pulling back from some overbought regions. What are your thoughts on the outlook for gold? Do you think that that was it for the rally, or what are your thoughts on that space?
Well, I think you have made the correct observation. When we got to 1304 on an intraday basis, it was tremendously overbought. I mean, it hadn't rested at all. And so it was due for some kind of correction. And that's what we're in now. But now, both gold and silver, gold having corrected to from 1304 intraday, we got to look down into the low 1240s this morning. I think that's probably it, because now the indicators are all starting to show oversold. Short-term indicators are turning negative today, and a little longer-term, what I call intermediate-term indicators, they will be turning oversold like Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. So this period between, Chris and I are talking on Thursday afternoon, by the way, listeners. So Monday through Wednesday of next week looks like a very good time to be adding the gold positions and silver, because, Chris, I still remain a bull. If we look at gold versus the stock market and the miserable prospects for the U.S. stock market, I still believe gold is going to be $1,900 next year. And so I've been a raging bull since before Christmas, and I haven't changed my horns a bit.
Well, it's interesting because there have been some big investors, and we were discussing this during the week. George Soros, to name just one person in particular, he is quite bearish on the stock market. He's betting against stocks, but he has taken a fairly big position on gold. Now, of course, I believe that refers to his quarterly holdings report relating to earlier this year. So it's hard to say whether or not he's still holding to that position or not. But it does look like there is a shift in the thinking of some large investors, smart money, if you want to call them, away from stocks to the more bearish side on the stock market, and a recognition that gold has perhaps turned and seen its lows and could be resuming its bull market cycle.
I think you worded that very good, Chris. You said that they're having doubts about the stock market, and they're recognizing that gold has got a bottom in. I don't think that either one of us are saying that the hedge fund industry is going to sell all their stocks and put all their money in gold. They're not going to do that. But I think your observation there and the wording you used was precisely correct.
Well, Ned, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners before you go? Tell our listeners certainly how they can find more of your work if they would like to.
I have two websites. One is valuevgoldreport.com, and the other is agrifoodvalueview.com. And you will find somebody that's an optimist on something.
More to come on the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the big picture, Chris Sheridan will engage in an in-depth conversation with Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. He's author of the 2015 book Blackout Wars and executive director of the Congressional EMP Commission, looking at the danger that either electromagnetic pulse or coronal mass ejection from the sun represents to the power grid and thus to everything in our way of life here in the West. And then a conversation between Chris Sheridan and I'm Chris Paplava, a detailed outlook of the U.S. economy and why, if current trends continue, there are growing signs for a major market top sometime this year, but a recession in 2017. All of that coming up next as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.